Captives. In southwest Israel, at the border of Egypt and the Gaza Strip, there is a small crossing station not far from the kibbutz of Kerem Shalom. A guard tower looms over the flat, scrubby buffer zone. Gaza never extends more than 7 miles in width, and the guards in the tower above the featureless plain can see the Mediterranean Sea to the north. The main street in Gaza, Salah el-Din Road, runs along the entire 25-mile span of the territory, and on a clear night, the guards can watch a car make the slow journey from the ruins of Yasser Arafat International Airport near the Egyptian border toward the lights of Gaza City on the Strip's northeastern side. Observation balloons hover just outside Gaza, and pilotless drones freely cross its airspace. Israeli patrols tightly enforce a 3-mile limit in the Mediterranean and fire on boats that approach the line. Between the sea and the security fence that surrounds the 140 square miles of Gaza live 1.5 million Palestinians. Every opportunity for peace in the Middle East has been led to slaughter. So it's not surprising that in the early morning hours at this isolated desert crossing on June 25, 2006, another moment of promise would meet the butcher. It had been a tumultuous month already. Hamas, which had convincingly won Palestine's parliamentary elections earlier that year, was waging civil war with its more moderate rival, Fatah. Armed factions ruled the streets. Then, on June 9th, a tentative truce between Hamas and Israel ended after an explosion near Gaza City, apparently caused by an Israeli artillery shell, killed 7 members of a Palestinian family who were picnicking on the beach. The Israelis denied responsibility. Hamas fired 15 rockets into Israel the next day. The Israelis then launched airstrikes into Gaza, killing 8 militants and 14 civilians, including 5 children. Amid this strife, Mahmoud Abbas, the head of Fatah and the president of the Palestinian Authority, the governing body established by the Oslo Peace Accords of 1993, put forward a bold idea. The people of Palestine, he declared, should be given the chance to vote on a referendum for a 2-state solution to its conflict with Israel. Perhaps it was a cynical political maneuver, as the leaders of Hamas believed. The fundamental platform of Hamas was its refusal to accept Israel's right to exist. Yet polls showed that Palestinians overwhelmingly supported the concept of 2 states. A referendum would be not only a rebuke to Hamas, it also would be a signal to Israel and to the rest of the world that Palestinians were determined to make peace. Abbas set the referendum for July. Then, as muezzins were calling the Muslims to prayer just before dawn on June 25th, 8 Palestinian commandos crawled out of a tunnel into a grove of trees beside the Kerem Shalom crossing. A new moon was in the sky, making it the darkest night of the month. With mortar fire and anti-tank missiles providing cover, the commandos, some of them disguised in Israeli military uniforms, split into 3 teams. One team attacked an empty armored personnel carrier, which had been parked at the crossing as a decoy. Another team hit the observation tower. The 2 Israelis in the tower were injured, but not before they killed 2 of the attackers. The 3rd team shot a rocket-propelled grenade into a Merkava tank that was parked on a berm facing the security fence. The explosion shook the tank. Then its rear hatch opened, and 3 soldiers tried to flee. 2 of them were shot and killed, but 1/3, lightly wounded, was captured. The attackers raced back into Gaza with their prize, a lanky teenager named Gilad Shalit. Within days, the Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, had bombed the only power station in Gaza, cutting off electricity to tens of thousands of people. The borders were shut down as Israeli troops searched residential areas for shalit, rounding up males older than 16. On June 29th, Israeli officials arrested 64 senior Palestinian officials, including a third of the Palestinian cabinet and 20 members of parliament. At least 400 Gazans were killed over the next several months, including 88 children. The Israelis lost 6 soldiers and 4 civilians. Israeli authorities promised not to leave the strip until they recovered Shalit. But by November, he still had not been found, and both sides declared a ceasefire. Nothing had been resolved. Another explosion was sure to come. Certainly, no one was talking about peace initiatives any longer, and that may well have been the goal of those who captured Shalit. From the Israeli perspective, the Gaza problem was supposed to have been solved in August 2005, when Ariel Sharon, then the prime minister, closed down the Jewish settlements on the Strip and withdrew Israeli forces. The international community and the Israeli left wing applauded the move. But almost immediately, mortar and rocket attacks from the Strip multiplied. 5 months later, Hamas won its parliament victory. We dismantled the settlements, and then we sat back and said, let's have a new beginning. What we got was rockets and Gilad Shalit. Ari Shavit, a prominent columnist for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, told me in 2009, 3 years after Shalit's capture. People became very angry, and Shalit becomes an icon of that frustration. We were sitting in Restobar, a noisy cafe in downtown Jerusalem. Nearby, Shalit's parents and supporters maintained a tent. From this makeshift office, they lobbied for Israel to release hundreds of Palestinian prisoners and detainees in exchange for Shalit's freedom. Shalit had just graduated from high school when he began his compulsory military service. His father, Noam, has described him as a shy boy with a nervous smile and a studious disposition, who loved basketball and excelled in physics. His plight was driving Israel slightly mad. There were demonstrations, bumper stickers, and petition drives demanding his freedom. On websites and in newspapers, counters chronicled how long Shalit had been in captivity. Many voters wrote in Shalit's name in the last presidential election. Israel is obsessed with Gilad Shalit in a way that no other nation in history has been obsessed with a prisoner of war, Shavit said. In practice, lopsided prisoner exchanges have long been a part of Israel's history. In 1985, for instance, Israel traded more than 1,000 prisoners for 3 soldiers captured in Lebanon. Some of those released went on to become terrorist leaders. One of them was Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, the quadriplegic schoolteacher who became the spiritual leader of Hamas, which was founded 3 years later. Attacks by the Hamas military wing inside Israel began in earnest in the early 1990s. In Restobar, Shavit pointed to a spot a few feet away. In March 2002, there was a beautiful 25-year-old girl, dead on the floor, right there, he said. A suicide bomber had targeted the cafe, which was then called Cafe Moment. That month alone, Palestinians killed 83 Israeli civilians. The entire country was in a panic. Like London during the Blitz, Shavit said. He was living nearby at the time, and at 10:30 on the night of March 9th, he heard the bomb explode. He rushed out of his apartment to the scene. I think I never ran so fast. The restaurant was oddly glowing, he said. He saw mutilated bodies scattered on the sidewalk. People had been blown across the street. The survivors were screaming or moaning, but inside the cafe, it was eerily quiet. The dead girl was lying near the doorway. Inside at the bar, three young men were sitting upright on the stools. But they were all dead. It was as if they were still drinking their beers, Chabot recalled. A party, frozen by death. 11 Israelis died, and more than 50 were injured. Hamas proclaimed it a brave attack intended to avenge the Israeli massacres against our people. Hamas, which was founded in Gaza, has come to embody the fears that many Israelis hold about the Palestinians. Its charter declares, "There is no solution to the Palestinian problem except by jihad." The document, which is in many respects absurd and reflects the intellectual isolation and conspiracy-fed atmosphere in Gaza at the time, cites the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the infamous anti-Semitic forgery, and links Zionism to the Freemasons, the Lions Club, and other spying groups that aim to violate consciences, to defeat virtues, and to annihilate Islam. In 2007, after Hamas solidified its control of Gaza, the Israeli government declared Gaza a hostile entity and began enforcing a blockade on a population that was already impoverished, isolated, and traumatized by years of occupation. Gaza became Hamastan in the Israeli newspapers, but Hamas was not weakened by the blockade. Instead, the collective punishment strengthened its argument that Israel's real goal was to eliminate the Palestinians. On June 25, 2007, several days after Hamas took over in Gaza, the captors of Gilad Shalit released an audio recording to prove that he was still alive. "It has been a year since I was captured, and my health is deteriorating," he said. "I am in need of prolonged hospitalization." He urged the Israeli government to accept Hamas's demands for his release. "Just as I have a mother and father, the thousands of Palestinian prisoners also have mothers and fathers, and their children must be returned to them." Hamas said that it would not free Shalit until Israel released 1,400 individuals, 450 of whom have been convicted of terrorist killings, including the men who planned the Cafe Moment bombing, the most precious commodity in all of the Gaza Strip, was its only Jew. Gaza is a sea of children. The average woman there has 5.1 offspring, one of the highest birth rates in the world. More than half the population is 18 or younger, and they are crammed into a ghetto with very little for children to do. The Israeli blockade included a ban on toys, so the only playthings available were smuggled, at a premium, through tunnels from Egypt. Music is rare, except at weddings. The movie theaters were burned down by Islamists in the early 1980s. Many of Gaza's sports facilities have been destroyed by Israeli bombings, including the headquarters for the Palestinian Olympic team. There's a zoo, where donkeys have been painted to look like zebras. Only one television station was broadcasting from Gaza, Al-Aqsa, a Hamas-backed channel that gained notice for a children's show called Pioneers for Tomorrow. It sought to shape the thinking of Gaza's children and help them cope with the repeated traumas of their lives. The host was a young woman named Sarah. Her co-hosts had a rather unfortunate history. There was Farfur, the mouse, who was beaten to death by an Israeli interrogator. Then came Nahul, the bumblebee, who died trying to cross into Egypt for medical treatment. The soldiers of the pioneers of tomorrow will grow up, Sarah exclaimed, after the rabbit, Asud, succumbed to an Israeli bomb. O Palestine, we will liberate your soil, God willing. We will liberate it from the filth of the Zionists. We will purify it with the soldiers of the pioneers of tomorrow. The message of the show was that life is brief and tragic, and counts for little except for the eternal struggle. Gaza's children were being groomed to die. The main diversion for children was the beach, and after noon prayers on Fridays, the shore was massed with families. Unlike the topaz waters off Tel Aviv, here the sea was murky, a consequence of 20 million gallons of raw and partially treated sewage dumped offshore every day. The main water treatment plant was broken, and because of the blockade, the spare parts that would fix it were unavailable. Fishermen with nets waded into the surf as kids romped in the stinking waves. Israeli authorities maintained a list of about 36 items that they permitted into Gaza. But the list was closely kept and subject to change. Almost no construction materials, such as cement, glass, steel, or plastic pipe, were allowed in, and the excuse that such items could also be used for building rockets or bunkers. Meanwhile, Hamas rocket builders and bomb makers smuggled everything they needed through the secret tunnels, as international aid organizations had to account for every brick or sack of flour. Operation Cast Lead, a three-week-long Israeli attack on Gaza, which began in December 2008, left Gaza in ruins. Half a year after the conflict, we don't have a single bag of cement and not a pane of glass, John Ging, the director of the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, for Palestinian refugees, told me. Humanitarian supplies that had been struck from Israel's list of approved items were piling up in large storage warehouses outside the Kerem Shalom crossing, and international aid, worth billions of dollars, awaited delivery. For the last two school years, Israeli officials have withheld paper for textbooks because hypothetically the paper might be hijacked by Hamas to print seditious materials, Ging complained. When John Kerry, then the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, visited Gaza in February 2009, he asked why pasta wasn't allowed in. Soon, macaroni was passing through the checkpoints, but jam was taken off the list. According to Haaretz, the IDF calculated that 106 truckloads of humanitarian relief were needed every day to sustain life for 1.5 million people. But the number of trucks coming into Gaza fell as low as 37. Israeli government officials told international aid officials that the aim is no prosperity, no development, no humanitarian crisis. Visitors enter Gaza at its northeastern end, through the Erez crossing, a high-security barn-like building that is rarely congested, since scarcely any Palestinians are allowed to exit, and so few foreigners care to visit. In 2004, the first female suicide bomber for Hamas, Reem Riashi, a 22-year-old mother of two children, blew herself up there, killing four Israelis. Since then, security cameras and remote-controlled gates have largely replaced the Israeli staff. In Gaza, the rocky hills of Jerusalem have been ironed into a sandy plain sparsely adorned with oleander and cactus, as in South Texas. The area near Erez used to be the region's industrial zone. Israeli forces concentrated much of their fire and their wrath on this area. Until Operation Cast Lead, there were several concrete plants, a flour mill, and an ice cream factory, but they were all bombed or bulldozed, and the mixing trucks for the concrete were toppled. Houses and mosques and shops lay in rubble. Entire neighborhoods were demolished. The 8 refugee camps in Gaza form a society that is even more isolated than the larger gulag of the Strip. More than 70% of Gazans are descendants of the 200,000 people who fled to the Strip in 1948 when the State of Israel was established. I lived 18 years of my life in a refugee camp, Ahmed Yusuf, the deputy foreign minister, told me. It was 1 square kilometer. We just knew the sky above us and the earth below. Eventually, Yusuf was able to gain the rare opportunity to go to the West for his training. He attended the University of Missouri. I thought at one time that Gaza was the center of the world, but when I left Gaza, I found no Gaza on the map. The boundaries of the modern Strip were determined after the 1949 armistice between Egypt and Israel. Gaza marked the final redoubt of the Egyptian army, and the armistice left a ribbon of coastal land between 3 and 7 miles wide in Egypt's reluctant control. British authorities, who had once administered Gaza as part of their mandate over Palestine, considered Gaza res nullius, nobody's property. The Egyptians administered the territory until the 1967 war, when Israel captured the entire Sinai. The issue of Gaza came up repeatedly during the 1978 peace negotiations at Camp David between Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin and Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. I myself suggested many times to Sadat, take Gaza, take Gaza. Aaron Barak, a former Israeli Supreme Court justice who was one of Begin's main advisors, told me. He said, I don't want Gaza. Israel and Egypt agreed to try to set up a Palestinian entity that would rule Gaza. But it was clear that neither party wanted responsibility for the Strip, so it remained in limbo. Little more than a notional part of a Palestinian entity that might never come into existence. Gaza's status as a ward of someone else's state changed abruptly with the 2006 elections. Fatah, long the dominant force in the 2 Palestinian territories, had been expected to win easily. But this underestimated popular resentment against a party that was famously crooked, incompetent, and so careless that it ran several candidates for identical offices. On the ballot, Hamas called itself the List of Change and Reform, although voters knew whom they were voting for. Polls had predicted that Hamas would receive about 30% of the vote. Instead, it won a decisive majority in the Palestinian Legislative Council. International organizations declared that in order for Hamas to be accepted, it would have to recognize the State of Israel, renounce violence, and respect extant diplomatic agreements. Hamas rebuffed these conditions, triggering a drastic cutoff of aid. Israel was further shaken when Ariel Sharon, the prime minister, suffered a debilitating stroke and fell into a coma. His replacement, Ehud Olmert, declared that the Palestinian government was becoming a terrorist authority and that the Israelis would have no contact with it. Fatah refused to step aside and let Hamas govern. For months, there were large demonstrations by both factions in the West Bank and Gaza, along with kidnappings, gun battles, and assassinations. In March 2007, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia arranged a peace accord, but it was merely a prelude to open civil war in Gaza 3 months later. During 6 bloody days in June, Hamas swept aside the American-trained Fatah security force and took over the government that it had been elected to lead the previous year. These clashes left a bitter residue. In Gaza Strip, we are crowded into a very small space. Yahya Rabah, a member of Fatah and a former ambassador to Yemen, told me, "Hate doesn't dissolve easily. We see each other every day." Although the new Prime Minister of Gaza, Ismail Haniyeh, emphasized that Hamas had no intention of making Gaza an Islamic state, it seized the judiciary, appointing Islamist judges who imposed Sharia on the court system. "The whole place is becoming a mosque," a young female reporter, Asma Al-Ghul, told me. She had recently been hassled on the beach by self-appointed morality police, even though she was wearing jeans and a long-sleeved shirt. An economist, Omar Shaban, said, "The siege has left Hamas with no competition. Secular people are punished. The future is frightening." On a searingly hot July day, I visited a Hamas summer camp. Hundreds of young boys in green caps shouted slogans before several top party officials who were seated under an awning in the courtyard of the school where the camp was taking place. One by one, the leaders stood to make speeches, exhorting the children with their flushed faces to struggle and sacrifice. I had come to meet with some of the men involved with the Shalit negotiations, in particular, Khalil El-Hayya, one of the early leaders of Hamas. As it happened, I had food poisoning. I wished I had paid more attention to the waiter the night before as I was ordering dinner. After my earlier examination of the polluted Gaza coastline, I had ruled out eating fish. I had decided to try the steak, which would have been smuggled through the tunnels. "Would you like that well done or very well done?" the waiter had asked. At 4 in the morning, I understood his caution. Finally, the droning speeches ended, the children dispersed, and Haya and I retreated to a classroom to talk. A former professor of Islamic law, Haya sported a graying beard and a prayer mark high on his forehead below his retreating hairline. He seemed serene and almost jolly, despite the constant threat of assassination, perhaps from one of the Israeli drones patrolling the sky. There was a semicircle of folding chairs set up in the classroom, where Haya and I sat, along with a dozen other Hamas leaders who came to watch the interview. I felt like Oprah, a nauseous and dehydrated Oprah. A ceiling fan barely stirred the broiling air. It was so humid I thought it might rain in the room. I asked Haya about the population explosion. The Israelis feel threatened by what they often call a demographic time bomb. Haya laughed and said that there was nothing sinister about the enormous number of children. "We just love to reproduce," he said. He has 6 living children himself. An Israeli bomb, which had been aimed at him, had killed a 7th. 5 minutes into the interview, I realized I was going to faint. As Haya was assuring me that Hamas stands for the Islam of tolerance and justice and equality, I suddenly found myself on the floor of the classroom. 2 men dragged a very sketchy mattress into the circle of chairs and covered it with prayer mats. I crawled onto the mattress and continued the interview, surrounded by the dusty boots of Hamas. Later, I reflected on this moment, thinking how reduced I sometimes feel as an American in the Middle East. How feckless are my good intentions, my attempts at understanding people whose hatred for each other is as unchanging as the sunrise. These concerned men, who were holding my hand and asking if I wanted water or a soda, anything to make me feel better, they were the same ones who were holding Gilad Shalit. The next morning, I visited a mosque where about 40 teenage boys were attending a day camp devoted to memorizing the Quran. The Islamic holy book contains more than 6,000 verses. It's about the same length as the New Testament, and this summer 20,000 boys and girls had undertaken the challenge in camps across the Strip. At the mosque, a small crowd was waiting for the Prime Minister, who was rumored to be coming to talk to the boys. Because the Israelis had targeted Haniya for assassination, they have fired missiles into his office and his home. He's constantly on the move. I was told that his visit to the mosque was my best chance to meet him. While the boys rocked back and forth on the carpet, reciting in low voices, I was introduced to an elderly refugee and a former member of the Palestinian Legislative Council. Bald and freckled, with a white mustache, he gave his name as Abu Majid. He was urged to tell me his story. On 15 May 1948, I was 22 years old, he said. Israel had formally declared itself an independent nation the day before, triggering the invasion by five Arab armies bent on destroying the Zionists. Egypt moved forces into the Negev Desert, approaching Beersheba, where Majid lived. The Egyptian army asked youngsters like me to help with logistics, he said. After one battle with the Israelis, Abu Majid and a friend dragged several wounded soldiers inside a bunker. A dozen people were already hiding there. That night, Israeli troops discovered the shelter and ordered everyone out. There were four old men over 70, one of whom had a wife who was 60 or 65, Abu Majid said. A younger, dark-skinned woman had two boys and a girl. Upon leaving the shelter, with their hands raised, they were all shot. I don't know why I'm alive, Abu Majid said. The blood came on me. I was one of three who God saved. We were 7 days in the desert of Negev before we reached the villages around Hebron. He had family there. His parents, believing him dead, had erected a mourning tent and were receiving condolences when a friend brought news that their son was alive. His brother slaughtered a sheep in celebration. As he told me his story, Abu Majid wept, the tears streaming into his mustache. I wondered, did this really happen? Israeli troops shooting down wounded soldiers and civilians who had surrendered, including elderly women and children? I checked Benny Morris's Definitive History, 1948, the First Arab-Israeli War, in which he noted that the fall of Beersheba was marked by many atrocities on the part of Israeli forces. A number of civilians were executed after being stripped of valuables, he writes. The survivors were expelled into Gaza. After 2 hours of waiting for Haniya to arrive at the mosque, some members of the audience gave up. Suddenly, the room began to stir. He's coming after all, a neighbor assured me. Several television reporters appeared, followed by a small convoy, and then Haniya strode in, waving at his supporters. He was 47, squarely built, with a round face and cautious green eyes that floated above a trim white beard. He was dressed in a stark white galabiyah and a skullcap, which added to his ministerial air. A former dean of Islamic University in Gaza City, Haniya grew up in one of the local refugee camps. In 1989, after the First Intifada, he spent 3 years in an Israeli prison. Then, in a decision that Israel deeply regrets, Haniya and 400 other activists were expelled to South Lebanon, where they formed an enduring alliance with Hezbollah. By Hamas standards, Haniya was a moderate. He had spoken of negotiating a long-term truce with Israel. That placed him at odds with many of the party's top officials. Khaled Meshal, the overall leader of Hamas, was living in exile in Damascus, Syria. A hardliner, he he was more likely to initiate radical destabilizing actions, such as capturing Gilad Shalit. A council dominated by representatives of its underground military wing governed the party. Because so many Hamas members have been assassinated, the movement operated as an unsteady collective. Even prominent party members didn't always know who was in control. Haniyeh's authority was further undermined by the fact that Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, dismissed him as Prime Minister of Gaza in June 2007 after the Hamas takeover and appointed Salam Fayyad, a Fatah loyalist, in his place. Hamas refused to recognize the move, and Haniyeh continued to govern Gaza while Abbas and Fayyad ran the West Bank under Israeli occupation. There were talks underway in Cairo to explore the creation of a unity government between Hamas and Fatah, and to make a deal for Gilad Shalit. The Israeli papers were full of expectation about an imminent prisoner swap, but Noam Shalit, Gilad's father, told me that the reports were ridiculous. He was pessimistic about the prospects for a deal anytime soon. Hamas ignores every aspect of international conventions, he said. They would like hardcore killers released. I feel very bad about that. He added that his son's abduction had become a bottleneck that had brought all negotiations to a standstill. At the mosque, Haniyeh addressed the campers on the importance of reciting the Quran. There are two kinds of people, he advised them. Those who know the Quran is right and who follow it, and those who turn their backs on the Quran. When he finished speaking, Haniyeh kissed each child who had memorized a third of the Quran and awarded him 50 Israeli shekels. Afterward, amid a crush of petitioners, I asked Haniyeh whether the Cairo talks had made any progress. It's just one step in breaking the siege of Gaza, he said, adding that he hoped the talks would allow reconstruction to begin. I asked if he had had contact with the Obama administration. Khaled Meshal had responded positively to Obama's June address to the Muslim world, welcoming the new language toward Hamas and calling for open dialogue. Haniyeh didn't answer directly. He said that Washington had no veto power over the choice of the Palestinian people, but added, "We are ready to deal." He also said that he would step down from his post if he became an obstacle to peace. "The most important thing is the unity of the Palestinian people. We are willing to do whatever it takes," he said, as the guards shouldered me aside. I made note of his comments, but wondered what chance he had to make peace if he couldn't even make a deal to release one captured soldier. I walked outside, among shuttered shops. "The term economy is no longer valid in the Gaza Strip," Omar Shaban, the economist, told me. In 1994, the poverty rate in Gaza was 16%. In the United States at the time, it was 14.5%. But by 1996, the Israelis had virtually shut out Palestinian labor, and the Second Intifada, 4 years later, put an end to tourism in Gaza. Before then, Shaban said, more than 10,000 people a month were visiting the territory, many of them Israelis who had come to enjoy Gaza's beaches and seafood. Most remaining economic activity abruptly halted in 2007 with the Israeli blockade of Gaza. 2 years later, according to the UN, about 70% of Gazans were living on less than a dollar a day, and 75% relied on international food assistance. Unemployment was practically universal, except for people working for international organizations or trading in the black market. According to the International Committee of the Red Cross, 96% of Gaza's industrial sector collapsed after Operation Cast Lead. Ever since the Hamas takeover, Egypt, Gaza's nominal ally, has cooperated with the Israelis in enforcing the blockade. The authorities in Cairo have their own reasons for sequestering Gaza. Hamas is a spin-off of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Egyptian government of Hosni Mubarak worried about contagion. The wall that defines the Gaza Strip along the Israeli border simply turns the corner upon reaching Egypt. In January 2008, Hamas improvised a radical solution to Egypt's restrictions by blowing holes in the security fence surrounding Rafah, the southernmost town in Gaza. Over the next 11 days, hundreds of thousands of Gazans streamed into the Sinai with shopping lists. The Egyptian police formed a cordon that kept Gazans from straying too far into the country. The shops along the border were soon empty. The Gazans went home, and the Egyptians sealed up the wall again. Although the West Bank is only 25 miles from the Gaza Strip, it feels in many respects even more distant than other parts of the world. The Israelis began requiring special permits for travel between the two halves of Palestine in 1988. When Taher al-Nunu, the chief spokesman for Prime Minister Haniyeh, was working in the foreign ministry, he was allowed to travel around the world, but like many Gazans, he's never been to the West Bank. I was in China, Istanbul, and Indonesia, but I didn't go to Nablus, Ramallah, and Qalqilah, he said. I began to see Gaza as, I suspect, many Gazans do, a floating island, a dystopian Atlantis, drifting farther away from contact with any other society. Omar Shaban told me that 20 years before he could easily drive to Tel Aviv for dinner, and more than 100,000 Palestinians traveled into Israel every day for work. The Palestinian economy was structured to work with the Israeli economy, he said. Most Palestinians knew Hebrew. There were real friendships. Now, he said, 2/3 of Gaza youth under 30 have never been outside the Strip. How can they psychologically think of peace? You can fight someone you don't know, but you can't make peace with him. A nervous-looking young man was pacing on the side of the narrow coastal road outside Gaza City, just past the ruins of the presidential palace, which had been destroyed during Operation Cast Lead. My driver stopped for him, and he got into the back seat without a word, indicating that we should continue driving south. It was a Friday afternoon, after prayers, and the beaches were crowded. Since the Hamas takeover, there have been many warnings that Al-Qaeda has infiltrated Gaza. In the summer of 2007, Mahmoud Abbas accused Hamas of shielding jihadists. Through its bloody conduct, Hamas has become very close to Al-Qaeda, he said. I had heard about several splinter groups in Gaza that were seen as Al-Qaeda affiliates. After extensive negotiations, I was able to arrange a meeting with a representative of one of them. The man in the back seat would guide us there. We drove past the site of a former Jewish settlement. Across the road were the remains of the greenhouses that the settlers had left behind, intact, with the understanding that Gaza farmers would take them over. The greenhouses were meant to become an important part of the agricultural economy. Gaza's main exports were strawberries, cherry tomatoes, and carnations, destined mainly for Israel and Europe. But then the Israelis clamped the borders shut, and the fruit rotted. The carnations were fed to livestock. Now the greenhouses are nothing more than bare frames, their tattered plastic roofing fluttering in the sea breeze. Our guide pointed to a rise ahead, where a lookout stood guard over another stretch of public beach. We turned into a sandy drive and parked behind a row of palm frond cabanas. The lookout ducked into a porta potty and emerged with an AK-47 and a 9mm pistol. Like the guide, he was quiet and unsmiling. He wore jeans and a plaid shirt. He led me to one of the cabanas, where a heavy man in a blue suit was waiting. The man said I should call him Abu Mohammed. He politely offered tea. Abu Mohammed claimed to represent four armed groups that have joined a jihadi coalition. There was such an alliance, called the Popular Resistance Committees. When I speak for all of them, he told me. We consider Osama bin Laden our spiritual father, he said his group followed the same ideology as Al-Qaeda, but there was no direct connection. The siege around Gaza has disconnected us from the outside world, he said. None of us can travel. In Gaza, he estimated, there were about 400 armed fighters in cells like his, down from as many as 1,500 before the Hamas takeover. When Fatah ran the strip, it was easier for subversives to operate, he said. But now, Hamas is in full control, and their power is very tight. Hamas, he explained, wanted to dictate when violence occurred in Gaza, and tried to keep the Al-Qaeda sympathizers like him penned in. As we talked, the lookout with the machine gun dragged in a table, and a tea boy arrived, carrying a tray and glasses. It was sweltering inside the hut. Abu Mohammed took off his jacket. His shirt was soaked through. He had a quiet voice and often stared into space as he spoke. He said he was a former political science student who had been jailed first by the Israelis and later by Hamas officials. He gestured to his suit jacket, now in his lap. During his second internment, Hamas brought in a moderate sheikh with a suit and a tie and the smell of roses to discuss the way we look, he said, in a wry tone. If I want to dress like my comrades in Afghanistan and Iraq, wearing the shalwar kameez, the uniform favored by jihadi veterans, that's prohibited. Finally, his jailers released him with a warning. Don't do anything against our ceasefire. He complained. We feel we're under a microscope. If an internet cafe or a beauty salon is burned, immediately they come round up the people they know. If Hamas suspects I am behind all this troublemaking, they will hang me by both hands and both feet for 30 days. That's the minimum. I asked what his main complaint was against Hamas. We thought Hamas was going to apply Islamic law here, but they are not, he said. He spoke of the fancy restaurants on the beach and said that Hamas tolerated uncovered women there. They have a much more moderate way of life, and we cannot deal with that. When I mentioned Gilad Shalit, Abu Mohammed smiled and said, I cannot talk about this, but a member of our group participated. Three factions claimed responsibility for the abduction, the armed wing of Hamas, the Popular Resistance Committees, and the Army of Islam. Mohammed said that the participant's name was Mohammed Farwaneya, and that he had been killed during the operation. Hamas had exclusive control of Shalit. Mohammed said of the arrangement, We respect this because of the higher interest of the exchange of prisoners. Recently, he said, his group had tried to carry off another abduction, but had failed. I asked him what drew young men into his movement. First, we have a clear ideology, he said. Some come because they like our style, and they don't want to live by the rules. Those we don't usually put our money on. When they're tortured, we're finished. Some come from Hamas and feel that they were not treated fairly. Others, like him, thought that Hamas was not following true Islam. Abu Mohammed said that most of the recruits were fellow refugees, but many are locals from hard-line families. Those who believe there is no middle road. Joint operations with Hamas, such as the Shalit abduction, had ended. "We have no meetings at all with Hamas," Abu Mohammed said. "It's almost as if they want to finish us." He met my eyes at last. "We know how strong they are, and how supported they are on the street, but we can't live underground forever." 6 weeks after this conversation, a group of radical Islamists, calling themselves the Soldiers of the Followers of God, stood on the steps of a mosque near the Egyptian border and declared Gaza to be an Islamic emirate. That afternoon, members of the Hamas military wing and the Gaza police surrounded the mosque, demanding that the radicals give themselves up. A shootout erupted, continuing into the night. At least 24 people were killed, including the group's leader, Sheikh Abdul Latif Musa. 100 people were wounded. I have not been able to determine if Abu Mohammed was a casualty. One of the Hamas fatalities was Abu Jibril Shimali, a commander of its armed wing. Israelis blamed him for orchestrating the capture of Gilad Shalit. Just outside Rafah, the smuggling capital of Gaza, there is a billboard with a portrait of Shalit, behind bars, juxtaposed with a photograph of a masked Hamas fighter. The Arabic text declares, "Your prisoner will not have safety and security until our prisoners have safety and security." In a place where commercial advertising scarcely exists, the billboard looked at first like another ubiquitous martyr poster. Shalit's pale features and meek expression haunt the imagination of Gazans. A powerful sense of identification had arisen between the shy soldier and the people whose government was holding him hostage. But the similarity rankled many. Like Shalit, Gazans were confined and abandoned. Unlike him, no one cared. Everybody talks about Shalit as if he's a holy man. Ahmed Yusuf, the deputy foreign minister, complained. "The whole world is showing such concern about a soldier who is still young and unmarried." Meanwhile, Israel was holding more than 7,000 Palestinians, nearly 900 of them from Gaza, who, like Shalit, were cut off from their families and are sometimes held without charge. "People say, what's the difference between their Shalit and our Shalits?" Yusuf remarked. "We are all Shalits." I spoke to Osama Mozini, a professor of education at Islamic University who was overseeing the Shalit negotiations for the government. A barrel-chested man with a stiff beard, he spent 5 years in an Israeli prison and was arrested 3 times by the Palestinian Authority because of Hamas activities. I asked him why he could not be more flexible in his negotiations for Shalit. Israel was plainly eager to make a deal that would involve the release of hundreds of Palestinians, many of them convicted of bloody crimes. Mozini bridled at the implication that the Palestinian prisoners were murderers and Shalit was not. "This one who has been abducted is an Israeli soldier who was on the border throwing shells that were killing Palestinians," he said. "We did not take him from the market or from his family. We took him from a military tank on the Gaza border." The IDF wouldn't say whether Shalit had been involved in military actions against Gaza. But the tanks that lined the border did lob shells into the territory, causing many random casualties. "While I was there, a teenage girl was killed and her young brother injured in such an incident." The Israelis maintained a buffer zone along the border, about half a mile deep, which placed at least 30% of the strip's arable land off limits. Every mile along the perimeter, there were remotely controlled machine gun emplacements called spot and strike, which were operated by an all-female crew using joysticks to pull the triggers at a remote Israeli base. Nearly every week there are reported cases of farmers being shot at, Mohammed Ali Abu Najila, an Oxfam researcher, told me. He said that Gazans understood the rule to be this: if I can see you, I will shoot you. Mazzini claimed that Gazans, whose relatives were being held in Israel, were not pressuring him to make a deal for Shalit. They are backing us up, he said. Everybody is asking us to stand firm to get our prisoners back, because this is our only chance. Mazzini began reciting the names of Gazan prisoners who had received sentences of more than 1,000 years. Hassan Salame, a Hamas operative, was serving 48 consecutive life sentences for recruiting suicide bombers. Walid Anjis helped plan the bombing at Cafe Moment and 2 other devastating attacks. He had 26 life sentences. Mazzini mentioned a prisoner named Abdel Hadi Suleiman Ghanem. He was riding in a bus. All he did was grab the steering wheel and take it over a cliff. He laughed. 16 people were dead, and many wounded. Even Ghanem was wounded. Ghanem received a life sentence for every person who died on the bus. These punishments struck Mazzini as ludicrous. He assured me that Israel had no choice but to comply with Hamas's terms. I went to Rafah to examine the tunnels that have created a subterranean economy in Gaza. Everything that went in or out of the strip, except the 36 or so commodities that Israel permitted to enter the territory, traveled through a hole in the ground. That included gas, cows, weapons, money, drugs, cars, which were disassembled for the trip, and people. There were hundreds of such tunnels, and they became a primary target for the Israeli Air Force during Operation Cast Lead. When I got there, a few months later, tunnel diggers were still repairing the damage, practically the only reconstruction work I saw in Gaza. A long, ragged row of tents ran about 50 yards from the Egyptian border amid great mounds of sand, and shirtless men worked their claims. Across the border was a village that had once been a part of Greater Rafah before the security fence divided the town. The workers aimed the tunnels at different buildings across the border, where collaborators would have hollowed out a bathroom floor or a spot under a bed. Most of the smuggling was done at night, honoring the conceit that the excavations were secret, even though an Egyptian police station nearby had a clear view of the tunnelers' tents. Occasionally, the Egyptians cracked down, blowing up or flooding the passageways. Tunnels also collapsed, especially after bombings which destabilized the soil. But tunneling was one of the few functioning industries in Gaza, accounting for some 35,000 jobs before Israel's December attacks. In the tunnel I visited, 3 men were on the surface and 20 were underground. A motorized pulley extracted buckets of sand. It can take 3 months to break through to the other side. The tunnel operator, a young man with a big smile and bright calcium deposits on his teeth, slyly introduced himself as Abu Hussein. The other men laughed. It's a pet name in Gaza for Barack Hussein Obama. The operator charged clients $1,000 to ship a ton of raw materials through the tunnel, or $50 for a bag of 40 kilos. He said that tunnelers frequently bump into one another underground. It's like Swiss cheese. It was through such a tunnel that the captors of Gilad Shalit crossed into Israeli territory. Old Soviet-designed Grad rockets, manufactured in North Korea and China, and knockoff missiles from Iran also made their way through the underground passageways, which was one reason that Israel felt the urgency to act. These weapons had a much greater range than homemade rockets. From the northern end of Gaza, the grads could reach Ashkelon, 7 miles away, a city of more than 100,000 people. According to the IDF, between 2000 and 2008, some 12,000 rockets and mortars were fired into Israel. Sometimes as many as 60 or 80 rockets a day were launched. But because they are so inaccurate, the number of Israeli casualties was relatively modest, fewer than 30 deaths. Still, the anxiety and fury stirred up by the fusillade placed the government of Ehud Olmert under extreme pressure in the run-up to the Israeli elections in February 2009. Across the Israeli border in Sderot, the police station displayed the exploded carcasses of hundreds of rockets that have landed in the area. Barack Obama had visited there as a candidate in July 2008. No country would accept missiles landing on the heads of its citizens, he said. If missiles were falling where my two daughters sleep, I would do everything in order to stop that. Despite Obama's assurances, the Israeli government decided to get the war over before the Bush administration left power. The stated goal for Operation Cast Lead was to destroy the terrorist infrastructure. But there were larger aims. We cannot allow Gaza to remain under Hamas control, Tzipi Livni, the foreign minister at the time, said. 6 months before the operation began, Israel and Hamas had agreed to a truce, but neither side really believed in the possibility of peace. Each had become so dehumanized in the eyes of the other that there was actual pleasure in contemplating the catastrophe about to fall on Gaza. The Israeli Deputy Defense Minister, Matan Vilnai, invoked the Holocaust, warning that Gazans were bringing upon themselves a greater Shoah because we will use all our strength in every way we deem appropriate. Meantime, Fatih Hamad, a member of the Palestinian Parliament, boasted that it was Hamas policy to use civilians as human shields. We desire death as you desire life, he said, speaking for all Gazans, half of whom are children, who were trapped inside the strip. On December 19, 2008, the 6-month truce between Hamas and Israel formally expired. Israel was willing to extend it, but Hamas refused. Hania complained that Israel had failed to ease the blockade, as the agreement had stipulated, and so Hamas rockets began flying again. By then, Gaza had run out of allies. Yossi Alfer, an Israeli political analyst and former Mossad officer, was in Europe when the invasion began. I was having a good stiff drink with a Saudi colleague, he recalled. He told me, this time, do it right. A few weeks before Operation Cast Lead began, Colonel Herzi Halevi, the commander of the 35th Paratroop Brigade for the IDF, was flying over the strip in a helicopter when he saw 3 rockets rise out of the Jabalia refugee camp. I saw the rainbow of smoke, and then 50 to 60 seconds later, you see it goes into Sderot, he told me. It's 11 o'clock in the morning. Children are in school. Whether they live or die is a question of whether they are lucky or not. This is something that no other country can accept. Halevi, now a brigadier general, is tall and lean and has a reputation for being an even-tempered, sometimes aloof commander. Like many Israelis, he had come to the conclusion that Gazans deserved what they were going to get. I had a feeling that on the other side of the fence in the Gaza Strip, we didn't find a leadership or even the sound of people in Gaza saying something different except fighting, shooting rockets, and kidnapping. His long career has taught him that in dealing with terrorism, if you are not decisive enough, it is not going to be effective. He had spent much of his career in Sayeret Matkal, an elite hostage rescue unit. It is likely that rescuing Gilad Shalit was another goal of the operation, although the IDF wouldn't comment on that. I told my soldiers that was not our mission, Halevi told me. Our mission was to take care that we do not become another Gilad Shalit. On the morning of December 27, 2008, a training exercise was underway at the police academy in Gaza City. Scores of police officers were in a courtyard. Across the street, children were getting out of school. A pair of Israeli F-16s screamed overhead, part of the first wave of aircraft aimed at police stations, command centers, and Hamas training camps. Explosions engulfed the courtyard. In less than 5 minutes, dozens of people were killed, and hundreds were wounded. At the school, many of the students were injured. As parents frantically searched for their children, another wave of aircraft raced over the strip, targeting the militants, who were expected to respond by launching retaliatory rockets. Indeed, one Israeli was killed that day by a Hamas rocket. According to the UN, the death toll in Gaza reached 280, with 900 wounded. It was one of the deadliest days of conflict between Israel and its neighbors since 1967. An Arabic teacher, who asked not to be identified, carried to Al-Shifa Hospital one of his students, a 14-year-old boy with shards of glass blown into his back and leg. That night, the teacher and his family stayed in their house. The bombing started again. It felt like an earthquake. Our home was shaking, he recalled. He was afraid that the windows would shatter, so he removed them. The weather was freezing, and the utilities in his home had been shut off. The next day he went foraging for food and fuel. A mosque near his house had been destroyed. Also nearby was Beit Lahia Elementary School, which the UNRWA had turned into an emergency shelter for 1,500 people. It had just been hit by white phosphorus artillery shells. Such munitions are usually employed to produce smoke screens, but they are also powerful incendiaries, and their use in civilian areas is considered a war crime. The smoke was very white, and when it comes on the ground, it doesn't explode, it just burns, the teacher recalled. The tentacles of fire that enveloped the school reminded him of a giant octopus. Two children burned to death. From the beginning, there was a dispute about who among the dead and wounded qualified as a civilian. Some police officers in Gaza had been recruited from the military wing of Hamas, but the Israelis regarded all police as Hamas apparatchiks. In several instances, armed drones killed children who were on rooftops. Were they spotters, as the Israelis speculated, or children at play, as human rights workers in Gaza contended? Such questions demonstrate the difficulty that any urban conflict poses in separating actual combatants from innocent civilians. They also underscore the biases that had taken root in each camp. The Israeli belief that Hamas terrorists and the Gazan people were one and the same. The Gazan tendency to support any act of resistance against the Israelis, no matter how self-defeating it might be. The air operation lasted for more than a week. Gaza's main prison was struck, with prisoners still in their cells. Drones crisscrossed the strip, using high-resolution cameras for precisely targeted missile strikes. Despite the accuracy of such weapons, Israeli and Palestinian human rights groups reported that 87 civilians were killed by drone strikes, including 12 people who were waiting for a UN bus. On December 30th, the Air Force began demolishing government buildings and cultural institutions. The Israeli authorities said they were going to destroy the infrastructure of terror, John Ging, the UNRWA director, told me. But they also attacked what he called the infrastructure of peace. such as the American International School in Gaza, the premier educational institution in the Strip. It had been attacked on two occasions by the extremists, Ging said. They did not succeed in destroying it. It took an F-16 for that. The caretaker of the school was killed in the attack. The ministries of finance and foreign affairs, the presidential palace, and the parliament were also struck. These are the buildings of democracy, Ging said. We in the international community have been building these for a decade, for a future state of Palestine, and they now lie in ruins. Over a six-hour period, several buildings in the UNRWA compound, housing the agency's food and fuel supplies, were shelled repeatedly, despite numerous calls from UN officials protesting the onslaught. Meanwhile, Hamas rockets continued flying into Israel. One hit a construction site in Ashkelon, killing a Bedouin construction worker and injuring 16 colleagues. A mother of four died when a rocket exploded near her car in the center of Ashdod. Another rocket landed in Beersheba, 25 miles from the Gaza border, injuring six Israeli citizens, including a seven-year-old boy. At Barzilai Hospital in Sderot, a rocket landed nearby. Maybe God prevented the hospital from being hit, the director Shimon Sharf told me. Then a Grad rocket struck a mall in the city. 20 minutes later, I had 85 patients in the ER, Sharf said. The next day, 130. Four or five of them, he said, were real casualties, including a woman who had shrapnel in her face. The remainder suffered from what Dr. Sharf diagnosed as post-traumatic stress. The Israeli military adopted painstaking efforts to spare civilian lives in Gaza. 2.5 million leaflets were dropped into areas that were about to come under attack, urging non-combatants to move to city centers. But Gaza is essentially a cage, and the city centers also came under attack. Intelligence officers called residents whose houses were going to be targeted, urging them to flee. The Israeli Air Force dropped roof knockers, small noise-making shells, on top of some houses to warn the residents to escape before the real bomb fell on them. During the 8 days of bombings, the Strip's water and electrical facilities were hit, and many mosques were destroyed. The Israelis assert that mosques served as arms depots for the resistance, and that Hamas placed its own citizens at risk by launching attacks from civilian areas. All the while, ground troops stood by on the perimeter of Gaza. None of the goals of the operation had been achieved. Every day there were rocket and mortar attacks from the Strip. Hamas remained in control, and Gilad Shalit was still missing. Hamas officials even baited the Israelis, saying, "We are waiting for you to enter Gaza, to kill you, or make you into Shalits." That prospect was very much in the minds of some military leaders. The Israeli press reported that soldiers were ordered to kill themselves if they were captured. No matter what happens, no one will be kidnapped, a company commander told his troops, according to the Tel Aviv newspaper Yediot Aharonot. We will not have Gilad Shalit, too. A ground invasion began on January 3rd, according to Amnesty International. Some Israeli troops were encouraged to fire at anything that moved. A number of soldiers spoke to a human rights group called Breaking the Silence about the behavior of Israeli forces during Operation Cast Lead. One said that his orders were, "You see a house? A window? Shoot at the window. You don't see a terrorist there? Fire at the window. In urban warfare, anyone is your enemy. No innocents." Another soldier said, The goal was to carry out an operation with the least possible casualties for the army, without its even asking itself what the price would be for the other side. A military rabbi told soldiers, "No pity. God protects you. Everything you do is sanctified. And this is a holy war." The ground troops attacked Gaza simultaneously from the north and the east. The soldiers expected fierce resistance, but the border areas were spookily empty. Some units spent a week in the strip without seeing a single Arab. Halevi led the paratroopers into the northeastern zone. The first night, he occupied a small town, Al-Tatra. "This is what I found," he told me later, in his office on a military base near Tel Aviv. He unfurled a map, drawn by Hamas fighters, showing where snipers were to be stationed. Tunnels had been dug, and improvised explosive devices had been planted. They took a civilian neighborhood and turned it into a military camp, Halevi observed. He showed me photographs of arms caches that his soldiers had uncovered in mosques, and of houses that had been booby-trapped. "This is the house of one of the Hamas officers in Al-Tatra," he said, projecting a photograph of a dummy standing beside a dark staircase. "The dummy is to make us think he is a soldier. Behind him was an IED. There was also a tunnel. The idea was that our soldiers see the dummy, they run to shoot him, and the IED explodes. Then the terrorists come out of the tunnel and kidnap our soldiers." Human Rights Watch reported 11 instances of Israeli troops shooting civilians carrying white flags, including 5 women and 4 children, one of many incidents that human rights groups say may constitute war crimes. According to Halevi, Hamas fighters had stationed weapons in various houses so that they could fire on the Israelis. When the troops approached, the fighters came outside, unarmed, carrying a white flag. Maintaining this guise, they ran over to another arms cache and resumed firing. Halevi also accused Hamas of using human shields. "If you launch a rocket and 2 seconds later hold a child in your hands in order to protect yourself from our helicopters, you are committing a war crime." Amnesty International has reported that it found no evidence that Hamas or other Palestinian fighters directed the movement of civilians to shield military objectives from attacks. Halevi told me, "The easiest thing would have been to attack from the air with cannons. Just erase the town. We didn't even think about that." He said his unit took extra risks in order to avoid civilian casualties. One of his officers was killed. "To speak about us like the tribes in Darfur or Bosnia, that really exercise war crimes. This is something I can't understand," he said. Most of Israel's immediate military goals were achieved within hours of the ground invasion. What followed was the systematic destruction of Gaza's infrastructure. Al-Quds Hospital, where many of the wounded were being treated, was shelled under the mistaken belief that a Hamas headquarters was in the building. Meanwhile, tanks fired on houses, mosques, and schools. The Israeli Navy strafed buildings along the coast and the intelligence headquarters in Gaza City. Armored bulldozers took down houses and factories. Israel's Deputy Prime Minister, Eli Yishai, later said, "Even if the rockets fall in open air or to the sea, we should hit their infrastructure and destroy 100 homes for every rocket fired." Houses that weren't destroyed were sometimes vandalized. Halevi had to send several soldiers back to Israel for ethical violations. We told them, "We don't want you. You have a level of morality we don't accept." But most of the damage was officially tolerated, if not encouraged. According to various international agencies, 14% of the buildings in Gaza were partially or completely destroyed, including 21,000 homes, 700 factories and businesses, 16 hospitals, 38 primary health care centers, and 280 schools. 13 Israelis died, including 9 soldiers, 4 of them from friendly fire, and 4 civilians who were killed by rockets. Israeli civilian casualties were kept to a minimum because many residents near the border fled the area, and those who remained hid inside fortified bunkers. Hamas claims that only 48 fighters were lost during the entire operation. The toll on Gaza civilians was far higher. According to Amnesty International, 1,400 Gazans died, including 300 children. 5,000 were wounded. Israel claims that only 1,166 Palestinians died, 295 of them civilians. Because the Israeli military forbade international observers and journalists to enter Gaza during the operation, the scale of the destruction was largely hidden from view. One voice in Gaza that became familiar to Israeli television viewers was that of Ezzeldin Abu al-Aish, a Palestinian gynecologist and peace activist who had trained and practiced in Israel. He often spoke to Israel's Channel 10, giving reports in Hebrew about the medical crisis in the Gaza hospitals. On January 16th, the day before the war ended, a tank shell went through a bedroom window of his fourth-floor apartment in Jabalia, killing 2 of his teenage daughters and a niece, and seriously injuring another daughter and several relatives. His oldest daughter ran into the room to see what had happened, only to be struck dead by a second tank shell. Moments later, he rang the Channel 10 newsman, Shlomi Eldar, on his cell phone, in the middle of a broadcast. Eldar answered on air, and the anguished wails of Abu al-Aish on the other end of the line jolted many Israelis. "No one can get to us," the doctor cried, begging for help to get his injured family to a hospital. "My God, Shlomi, can't anyone help us?" Eldar persuaded the Israeli army to let ambulances through to rescue the survivors. The IDF initially claimed that Palestinian rockets had struck the building, and then, after that was disproved, that the Israeli tank was responding to suspicious figures on the third floor. Later still, the IDF admitted that the tank had fired the 2 shells that killed the girls. "We have proven to Hamas that we have changed the equation," Tzipi Livni said on January 12th, 5 days before Israel declared a unilateral ceasefire and started to pull out of the Strip. "Israel is not a country upon which you fire missiles, and it does not respond. It is a country that when you fire on its citizens, it responds by going wild." The morning that the Israelis began their withdrawal, Hamas launched 5 more missiles at Sderot, then declared its own ceasefire. Khaled Meshal, who was in Damascus, far from the action, claimed victory for Hamas. In June 2009, 5 months after Operation Cast Lead, Hamas sponsored a workshop in Gaza City titled How to Talk to Israel. 2 dozen people attended, most of them academics or journalists. "What Israel knows about Hamas is that Hamas wants to eliminate them," one of the panelists observed. "Governing imposes new responsibilities," he said. "But since coming to power, Hamas has not changed its speech." A member of the audience said that Hamas had not even decided what to call Israel, pointing out that some speakers had used the term Israeli entity, and others had called it the Zionist entity. You can't say to our own public you're going to throw Israel into the sea and then talk another way to the outside world. You have to have one speech, the audience member said. We address moderates in Israel with words, and then we also send rockets to them. We should be responsible, but also clear in what we want. The world is not going to wait for us forever. Many Gazans I spoke to were introspective about Israel's crushing retaliation. A Palestinian aid worker saw the invasion in geopolitical terms. The war has a double meaning for the whole world, but especially for Iran, he said. This is how it will be for anyone who would think to play with Israel. Eman Mohammed, a young photographer, told me that she was shocked by the indifference of the Arab world compared to the West. Look at the U.S. and Britain sending convoys of aid, she said. Maybe we needed this war to look at things in a different way. The sight of buildings being destroyed in Gaza made her more sympathetic to the reaction of America to 9/11. I thought Osama bin Laden was a hero, but he's not. He's just a corrupted man taking us all to hell. The teacher in Gaza told me that many children have been reluctant to return to class because that's where they were when the bombs began to fall. The Ministry of Education and Higher Education has reported that 164 pupils and 12 teachers were killed during the operation. Some of the children have become extremely aggressive, forming gangs. They don't listen. They don't care what you're saying, the teacher told me. Others are mute. But as soon as they hear a loud sound, they start screaming. The boy he carried to the hospital has become one of the disruptive ones. Before the war, the boy was good at his lessons. Now he has a dark future, the teacher said. If he doesn't continue his learning, he is not going to be able to go to the university. He will lose his opportunity to be an effective member of the community. Soon you will see him on the street. Ahmed Yusuf warned me. If there's not a solution in the near future, things will go out of control. At every level, you find people suffering from a siege mentality. They don't know which direction to take. There's no guidance from the world community or from our local leaders. We have lost the wise men among the Palestinians. Hamas became more firmly entrenched in Gaza than it was before the invasion, and quickly began rearming with high-quality weapons, many of them supplied or paid for by Iran. The Israelis watched in frustration. I tell you, we will come again, General Halevi said, in better shape, because we have learned our lessons. Soon after the troops returned to Israel, Chaim Ramon, then the vice premier, declared that Israel is facing a serious humanitarian crisis, and it is called Gilad Shalit. He added, until he is returned home, not only will we not allow more cargo to reach the residents of Gaza, we will even diminish it. In July, the incoming prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, echoed this position. On October 2, 2009, Hamas released a proof-of-life video of Gilad Shalit in exchange for the release of 20 female Palestinian prisoners. Shalit appeared gaunt but healthy. 3 months earlier, Shalit's father, Noam, testifying before a UN committee, had made the case that his son's abduction and the refusal of his captors to allow the International Red Cross to determine if he is alive and well were war crimes. He used the forum as an opportunity to address the people of Gaza. Your leaders are fighting to return your sons and daughters from captivity, he said. This is an understandable desire. But he added, the fate of an entire prison population cannot depend on the ransom of one young man. You know that the injustice done to my son was the trigger for war. You also know that the release of my son is the key to peace. I know that you are short of food, he went on. Some of your loved ones have been killed, women and children, young and innocent. As a parent, speaking to a multitude of parents, I ask you to understand my family's anguish. Postscript. On October 18, 2011, 5 years after his capture, Shalit was finally exchanged for 1,027 Palestinian and Israeli Arab prisoners. Collectively, they had been responsible for the deaths of 569 Israelis. According to reports, dozens of them have returned to paramilitary activity. Shalit became a sports reporter for Yediot Acharonot, Israel's largest daily newspaper. In July 2014, Israel launched another military operation into Gaza with the goal of reducing Hamas rocket attacks and destroying the tunnel network. More than 2,000 Gazans were killed in the month-long war, most of them civilians, according to human rights groups. Israel reported 66 soldiers killed, as well as 5 Israeli civilians and 1 Thai worker.